Hi, Michael Friedman. Welcome to KABU for part two of our interview on COVID-19.
Thanks, Bill. I'm glad to be here with you again.
Mike Friedman is an evolutionary biologist studying microbes, teaching and writing in the biology department at the University of Antigua and Barbuda in the Caribbean. For the last several years, he's been studying and writing on the development of dangerous viruses around the planet, including COVID-19. That respiratory disease has now been detected in over 360,000 people in this country, which is more than double any other country, including populous China. And it's now killed over 10,000 at this date, which is an undercount because many people who died were never tested. This interview was recorded last week, Monday. Today, when you're hearing it, the figures will be much worse, maybe with 20,000 deaths and many more to come. In the first part of the interview, Mike discussed the origins of the virus and the conditions of its transfer to humans. He discussed how our current economic system, its relentless expansionism going to the ends of the earth and the depths of the ocean, making a lot of money, but devastating ecological systems and putting animals into closer contact with humans. He also discussed the virus's ease of transmission, also that it can be spread by people who show no symptoms, and also that it very quickly spreads in populations with no prior immunity, leading to a very large number of cases and thus mass death. The second part will build on all that to discuss first short-term solutions when a new virus surfaces, solutions that were done in China, Korea, and Germany to good effect, to say the least, and not done in this country, though epidemiologists issued from early on progressively more desperate warnings. And we'll be discussing long-term solutions, how humanity can act so that fewer of the viruses are created and passed to humans. A hint, it would require a very different economic system than we have now. So some things can be done today that would reduce virus attack frequency and prepare for that alternative system. So, Mike, what did China, Korea, and Germany do, apparently stopping the virus?
Well, for one thing, except for China, they started early. Germany and South Korea had preparations in place as soon as the epidemic began spreading in China. The second thing they did was implement massive testing. So South Korea, for example, was doing 20,000 tests a day, I believe that was the figure, while the U.S. from December to February, had only done about 1,000 or 2,000 tests throughout the country. So testing is critical. When the testing began revealing the points of contact, they were able to implement contact tracing and then various mechanisms of containment, social isolation. So they would trace contacts, and then they would isolate people who tested positive or came in with symptoms. All of this was done very expeditiously, and that allowed South Korea, Singapore, Taiwan, now Germany is considered to be a good example, to deal with the pandemic and to actually hold the numbers down. Whether it continues to hold the numbers down is something that needs to be monitored.
Yeah, often the economic geniuses of those countries decide we have to open the country and regain our consumption and profits, and they do it very soon, and still the virus is still there, and most of the population has not gotten it, right? The immune system wasn't challenged, and therefore you get up and bump a second great outbreak of cases. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know very much about the development of immunity to this disease. So that still is an open question. What percentage of the population will develop immunity? How they'll develop immunity and for how long the immunity will last? There have been some indications of reinfection in some places, whether that's because of faulty testing or because of actual reinfection, we aren't sure. So these are open questions.
If it follows, though, the pattern of the common flu, the immunity lasts for a year or two or three, something like that. Is that what the scientists have found?
Yeah, the virus mutates, and you have to develop a new vaccine every year. But in the case of coronavirus, there's another problem, which is there's some discussion over whether the way the immune system responds to the virus will actually produce the degree of immunity that we need. So there's some discussion over that. Yeah, we will see some immunity, but no one really knows how much.
Mike, what happened in the U.S.? Tell us why we haven't, why the United States is so late and is going to have so many deaths.
Well, as most of your listeners probably already know, the biggest shortcoming is structural. I mean, we've had four decades of neoliberal austerity, which have reduced the healthcare system, have reduced the stocks of supplies and protective equipment, beds, hospital beds. So I think this is a basic difference, in fact, between the U.S. in a way and the U.S. and Germany. Germany has also experienced austerity, but some of the original social democratic programs that were in place following World War II are still in place in Germany. So in the U.S., what happened was, on top of these structural failures, you had a problem, well, you had more specific issues related to this, like the CDC failing to produce a viable test kit, and then failing to take this seriously enough to get it out, and imposing criteria for testing that were very, very strict. So that was one side. Then they also limited the ability of the states and of private companies to produce their own test kits. They put a lot of red tape in the way of doing this. And they also refused to use the German kit, which had been around since February, I believe. So Germans produced the test kit, which they were using, and which the WHO adopted. Then you have other issues, like, for example, the private drug companies. This is not related to the onset of the disease, but they showed their colors when they, at least a couple of them, refused to say whether they would make any antivirals or vaccines available to the public cheaply and easily. Then there was an outcry, and I believe one of the companies backed down and said, yes, what they were working on would be made available. So those are a few of the ways that we were off to a slow start. So the U.S. started very slow, and it started very slow from the top down because Donald Trump was a little bit more concerned about reassuring Wall Street than about actually sending a clear message about how to deal with the virus and taking steps to do so.
Yeah, the Army, apparently, the military had established in the National Security Council, that's their peak association advising the president, to set up a pandemic task force because the Army, as terrible their uses are around the world, they have some smart people on top who actually have done risk assessment, and they have found that pandemics are an enormous risk, along with climate change, actually. What they would do about it is another matter. And then they set up this group in the National Security Council to plan and advise the president and blah, blah. Anyway, he shut it down, didn't he, early in his term. It was sort of incomprehensible that they would do that. But
yeah, he eliminated that office. In line with his other anti-science and anti-working class measures, I mean, he took public health officials off of his, once he set up his panel under Kushner, the COVID-19 panel or group that he had assigned the task of coming up with policy, he took public health officials off of that, off of his COVID-19 panel. And, you know, he placed the panel under Vice President Pence, who has no expertise in public health. Then he also classified the information coming out of that panel so providers don't have access to the data they need.
Yeah. And then finally, he decided that Pence wasn't doing what he wanted, so he put Jared Kushner as head of it. This is Bill Resnick here for Bill Mole interviewing Mike Friedman, microbiologist. observes and studies viruses like COVID-19. Last week, we discussed the origins of the virus transferred to humans, including that the recent very frequent appearance of new novel viruses has to be attributed to the relentless penetration and consequent devastation of jungles, forests, other lands, like companies and governments going after the oil or hardwoods or minerals or cow pastures to make money. We just in the second part of the interview discussed what must be done after a virus is discovered to stop the potential pandemic and give time for science to develop vaccines. Next, we'll talk about what can be done long-term to reduce the novel virus origination, to stop pandemics, and to greatly reduce death. Mike, last week you discussed Wuhan province in China where COVID-19 had its first reported outbreak and deaths. Although you also pointed out that the great increase in novel viruses being passed to humans is a global phenomenon, and at least in one developed country, this one. Tell us about that, the viruses that have developed in this country and why, like Lyme and Hanta and maybe more.
Very briefly, there's been a big upsurge in the past 40 years, which is why I said that these emerging diseases and outbreaks are a true product of the Anthropocene. The upsurge in the U.S. has been accompanied by increasing agribusiness, increasing suburban development, increasing extractive industry development, and so on. These are all associated with deforestation, with bringing populations of people into closer proximity with vectors and primary hosts, and allowing these hosts to proliferate. So hantavirus, for example, is a rodent-borne virus in the southwestern United States, and it began proliferating when the suburbs began spreading, or really intensified their spreading, like in Arizona, New Mexico, and so on. And this is associated with increased agribusiness and irrigation and so on in the Southwest, and also with suburbanization and urbanization. So we have these industries to thank, along with the real estate industry and financial industries. And so it's all market driven. If people want a good take on how this is occurring, they can look for some of the work of Rob Wallace, a biologist who wrote a recent article in Monthly Review. He talks about this.
Yeah. What about Lyme disease?
Lyme disease is also associated with land development and deforestation in the northeastern U.S. So the real estate industry began, you know, after World War II, began promoting the sprawl of suburbs. And these suburbs are very favorable habitats for the deer mites, which spread Lyme disease. And then on top of that, you also have the effects of climate change, because with climate change, the vectors and hosts of the Lyme disease bacteria are spreading out across northern U.S. And they're finding cases of Lyme disease that have moved like into Michigan and further west.
Yeah. Mike, I know that the publications that you publish in cover the devastation of nature by our current economic relationships. It's called capitalism. And those publications also talk about alternatives to capitalism, and point out we have to end capitalism, its relentless growth that ignores the fact that you can't have infinite or exponential growth on a finite planet. Say a few words on that, the way you understand it. But then I think we have to talk about what can be done in the struggle with capitalism and with this relentless growth. There are things that can be done that will, in fact, reduce novel virus origination, as well as the transfer to humans and all of the deaths. But first, tell us, you know, give us your statement on the problem of exponential growth.
Okay, well, I mean, I think not the biological root of pandemics, because those have always been with us, and there's always a chance that some disease is going to emerge and spread out. But kind of the roots of our current situation, in which you're having widespread outbreaks of very virulent diseases at an increasing pace is kind of due to the intrinsic dynamic of a market economy, which is based on, incessant growth, capital accumulation, destruction of the environment, which is considered an externality, as well as the health of working people. And in the process, you set up the dynamic that I mentioned before, where you are fostering contact between humans, especially vulnerable humans, and these diseases. You're reducing biodiversity, which favors these diseases. So, the solution, the bottom line kind of, for assuring that we have some control over these emerging diseases is to eliminate the market economy.
Yeah, that'll take a while, though. I think it's truly eliminating itself, actually. It's creating the conditions for its replacement. That may be too Marxian for some, but it seems that they're not going to be able to get out of this one. They're not going to be able to jumpstart growth to get out of a crisis, which they've always done before. They have to stop growing in the way they are, and they're unable to even imagine doing that. They will make conditions that will destroy them. In the meantime, though, and it will take a while because they have such political hegemony, indeed domination, there are things that we can do now, it seems to me, that would both prepare for that day of replacing capitalism, that we can prepare for that as well as reduce the amount of misery and death from these novel viruses.
Okay. I mean, the way I kind of envision it is that we need sort of an expanded Green New Deal. We need a program that's going to address these environmental issues while providing jobs and economic security, food security, housing security, you know, basic needs for people. And at the same time, we need a Medicare for all. So we need to amplify the Green New Deal to incorporate Medicare for all, universal health care, I would say, because both of these are necessary in the short and in the long run to prevent and stop these pandemics from taking the toll they do.
In Germany, in fact, it does still have a medical system set up by social democrats, although practicing austerity in many other ways. In Germany, the health system was fully prepared, and they have, in fact, had very few, at least the reports. And German reports are usually accurate nowadays. U.S. reports and others are very questionable. But at least their reports show very few deaths per case discovered, although, of course, they also tested so many people that they have very many cases. But they also have very good, they have a medical system that gets to people who are having the early signs of the disease and treats them. And it seems to me that early treatment can be greatly reduce deaths.
Yeah. So, I mean, what you're talking about is a much more robust healthcare system and also public health system. And Germany certainly has great advantages in those over the United States. The other side of it, though, is the need to reduce the causes of these outbreaks, which does imply an entire environmental component. We need to begin looking at how to protect ecosystems and prevent biodiversity decline. And that involves things like agroecological production. It involves things like setting aside areas which maintain, you know, original ecosystems.
It also involves restoring some of the damaged ecosystems.
Exactly. But it also involves assuring that people have enough food to eat and aren't constantly being forced off the land to move further into forests to find food or to cultivate, bringing them into contact with reduced and immunocompromised animals that are being affected by this biodiversity decline. I remember when I lived in Nicaragua, a big problem was that the landowners would push the poor campesinos, the poor farmers, off their land. And then they would migrate further into the forest and slash and burn the forest. And what we know now is that these type of activities expose people to the risk of contracting various pathogens from organisms that are being pushed into smaller and smaller spaces and with reduced diversity.
Yeah, and also, of course, aggravating climate change, producing more greenhouse gas emissions. Mike, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks, Bill. It was really nice joining you today. We'll talk to you later.
Right.
Pandemic is spreading. The health system's collapsing. You can watch it all unfolding on the screen. If you're afraid to go outside, enough groceries to hide, it may have been weeks since you have seen someone you can touch, and you miss it so much as you wonder what might happen next. Like when your savings run out and the choice is all about what kind of help you might be able to expect. Or perhaps when COVID arrived, while some struggled to survive, you were what they call essential. It didn't take long to see you got that wrong. The word they really meant was expendable. It didn't take long to see there was no emergency. Plans in place for something which all the scientists knew was just a matter of when there'd be a pandemic again. And the kleptocrats in power didn't have a clue. Otherwise, why did Jason Hargrove die?
We just heard a piece from David Rovick's new song, Essentially Expendable, The Death of Jason Hargrove. Hargrove is the Detroit bus driver who needlessly passed away from his exposure to COVID-19, representing one of many thousands of blue-collar workers who have been on the front lines of this pandemic but lack the support of employers in providing adequate protection.